This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Maple sugaring is one of those traditional images of a long-ago Vermont that has endured into the 21st century. But as much as it is an iconic exercise of Vermont living, there's a business to it, too. And today we'll look at the economics of maple syrup. From the macro side, there's an institution in Canada called the Global Strategic Maple Syrup Reserve. I'm not making that up. Last year, Carolyn Sear of the Federation of Quebec Maple Syrup Producers, which operates the reserve, told us how it works.
The producers here in Quebec have established this reserve in 2000 in order to be able to develop new markets, because we know that if we want to have new markets, we have to be able to supply the product. And since maple syrup is a seasonal product, we don't have the choice to have syrup in stock. So that's why we are keeping a percentage of each crop in storage.
The Federation keeps almost 70 million pounds of syrup in storage, and the premise is to keep a supply in stock to protect against bad sugaring season. This stabilizes the market from year to year.
It happens in 2007, the reserve went emptied because we had a few years of poor harvests, so we had to take syrup from the reserve.
Quebec has more than 7,000 syrup producers, and whatever is not sold during a year goes into the reserve. The Federation also sets the price for all maple producers in Canada and limits what volume is heading onto the market from the country's sugarers. The price is negotiated with the syrup producers.
Each year, we have to sit down with an organization. It's called Conseil de l'Industrie de l'Érable, which represent the authorized buyers of maple syrup here in Quebec. So the Federation is the voice of all the producers, and we discuss a marketing agreement for the maple syrup produced in bulk. And in that marketing agreement, we have the price that will be given to the producer for the product. And it's negotiated once a year, and the price are known before the new crop.
It should be noted that when we spoke with Sear of the Quebec maple syrup producers last year on March 25th, she told us that their syrup season was just starting. What a difference a year makes. So that's the macro side of the equation. Now we'll talk a little bit more micro. We'll discuss the economics of the syrup industry in Vermont and the economics of individual operations. I'm joined by Mark Canella, UVM Extension Farm Business Specialist, and Florence Picot, Research Specialist for UVM Center for Rural Studies and the author of the Center's study of Vermont's maple industry. It's a pleasure to have you both on the program.
Thank you, Jean.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So, Mark Canella, can you start just by painting us a picture of the maple landscape? So small versus large producers, geographical distribution of sugaring operations, et cetera.
Sure, yeah. You know, we've got maple production in all forms across the state of Vermont. And for our neighbors and colleagues in New York and New Hampshire, there's some of it that happens there, too. There's a long cultural heritage of sugaring as family operations and community operations. There's also a very long economic history of sugar production or syrup production in various forms, going back hundreds of years. With Extension, we work with folks that run the gamut there, from hobby through to complementary business enterprises and larger, full scale and direct commercial operations. So we've got it all parts of the state, a little different from operation to operation and place to place, but it is all maple, and generally the product all comes out in very similar forms.
And does it look the same? I mean, are there more operations in the Northeast Kingdom than, say, down in Bennington County?
You know, that's a great question, Jane. In my work, we've actually been working with a variety of producers around the state. I think some of the trends, there's certainly heavier production in Franklin Orleans that we've been observing. And we have producers that are in the southern part of the state, but it's not so easy just to pick geographic spatially, because we've got a lot of different microclimates. The syrup production is everywhere, but we've got low valleys that may not be as suitable or may not perform as well. And then we do have people moving upslope into higher altitude production or more northern climates. It's different everywhere. It's a pretty unique situation.
Florence Picot, I mentioned that the industry is changing a little bit. Vermont has more than doubled its syrup production in two decades. So that's production volume, not sales and money. That's actual amount of maple syrup we're producing?
Yeah, actually, if you look, whether you look at sales or volume produced, both have increased significantly.
What's interesting about that to me is that, you know, it takes many years in some cases, and still even several years, even if you're doing some new kinds of syrup experimentation with saplings, it takes many years for the trees to be mature enough to be tapped. So we're talking about an industry that's developed with trees that were already in existence in Vermont, right? This is not sort of new agricultural land that's suddenly being planted for maple.
Right. But I think, you know, from what I've heard anecdotally from talking to the president of the Vermont Maple Sugar Makers Association, some of the estimates is that less than 10% of the maple trees in the states are currently being tapped. So that shows you that the potential is actually rather big.
So we still have the chance to expand our production if we wanted to.
We do. And I think it's happening.
Well, clearly, if we're expanding the volume, it must be happening, because, I mean, there are also new production methods that you can extract more sap and at a lower ratio of water to sugar, but you're still going to have to be tapping more trees if we want to expand production. And are you seeing, when you look at the research, larger producers coming on the scene or producers are snapping up more stands of maple, or are you seeing an even distribution of small and large?
I think it's a tricky thing to answer, question to answer, because my understanding when working on this study was, if you look at the number of maple producers based on the United States Department of Agriculture estimates, is that you have about 1,500 producers in the state. When you talk to the industry, they believe that there's between 1,800 to 3,000 producers. So it is tricky to measure. I would say that if you're large, you're most likely going to be counted by the Census of Agriculture, versus if you're smaller, you know, it's a backyard operation, and if you have a few hundred taps, you're most likely not going to get counted in the census.
And you're not counting people like me who have 1 to 3 taps.
No.
Mark Canella, what are you seeing in terms of that size thing? I mean, we see this in agriculture all the time, this idea of, can small operations withstand the onslaught from bigger operations and have that economy of scale? Are you seeing small producers get squeezed, or is there still room here for both small and large producers in our maple industry?
Oh, yeah. I don't think there's any onslaught in the maple industry between large and small. I think there's opportunities at all levels, and the work that we've been doing in the past 2 years with financial tracking has actually been very helpful to show that profitability can be had at the farm level, regardless of scale. And I'll certainly say that your one tap, I think, might not be such a great economic proposition.
I lost a lot of money on that one. If I
came out and did the calculations, we could send a behavioral economist out there to fully justify your here.
I'm just trying to participate, Mark.
Exactly. No, definitely. And I think the work that we're doing right now, we did some cutting off, and we decided that we weren't going to work with producers less than 2,500 taps. Because we felt that there was a reasonable cutoff there where they had the intent to be commercial and they were moving enough money through their business to feel like it warranted that level of rigor of planning and analysis. And we have been able to see people definitely demonstrating profits at that scale, 2,500 to 3,000 taps. And then straight through to, we're working with some producers above 50,000 taps. And they all have unique models and unique practices and best practices for their particular operation that can make them work. So I think the opportunity is there. Yeah, I think that from what our understanding of the tree inventory, it is there as well. And the great thing about forest management is that there's often a management perspective of regeneration and stocking for next generation. So those trees have been coming up for 60 or 80 years and are there. So the opportunity is there. And then we did mention a little bit about just the sap collection, the technology and the innovation, and also the smart management going into that as well, is allowing people to get more sap out of trees rather than add that extra tap.
Mm-hmm.
So we might still be able to get a little more sap out of that one tap you've got, and maybe we'll get a business plan out of that soon.
Yeah, I'm not holding out for a lot of hope on that being my second career, but maybe someday, Mark. Yeah. Florence, you wanted to weigh in as well.
Yes. I think if we look from the marketing side of things and where the maple syrup gets sold, the smaller operations tend to sell directly to consumers. So that might be consumers coming to your farm during open house, versus the larger producers. They sell directly through the packers and wholesalers, because at the level that they operate, they don't have time to find their own markets. So my sense is that there is room for both. There's room for the small-scale operator that participates kind of in the working landscapes idea that we have in Vermont, and then that attracts tourism. And then you have the large-scale where most of their products are being shipped out of Vermont to national and international markets.
And, of course, there's a different price for wholesale or retail that the
yes.
producer is going to be getting depending on what they're, where
right,
they're selling.
Right. So if – and Mark, I'm sure I can speak of that, but my sense is that if you're smaller and you sell directly to consumer, you're capturing more of the price. And so even if you're not as efficient in terms of production, you can capture a higher price than if you're large scale where efficiency is key.
We are going to talk a little bit about that. And listeners, I'd love to ask you for your thoughts if you're listening to this and think about it as a viable business for you or something that you are either looking to get into or are in. And how do you make it work? How do you make it work for you and your family and the economics? We're talking about the economics of maple. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. While we're talking about sort of the scale of producers, we got a note from Bruce who says, I annually help my friends in Berlin who produce roughly 200 to 250 gallons of syrup. Maple sugaring certainly is iconic and has an attractive Currier and Ives allure. Yet, what do your guests think about recent trends towards industrial sugaring, like the Sweet Tree up in Island Pond? Financed by out-of-state investment management firms and insurance companies, Sweet Tree is on its way to becoming the Exxon of maple sugaring, Bruce says. Yet, as a supposedly agricultural operation, it and others like it seem to be largely exempt from land use laws. I also understand that their treatment of the land leaves a lot to be desired. Mark, where do you fall on that question?
Well, that's a pretty hot question for an extension educator. I'd say that I've been at meetings and I've heard that term industrial maple come up, and I got to admit I prickle a little bit at that terminology when I think about some of the larger operations and some of the family-based operations that are certainly growing to larger scales. I personally like to use the word industrious maple a little bit better because there are people that are finding out ways to generate return from land that otherwise didn't generate enough of a return to be competitive with other development pressures that we're seeing, you know, across the state, some of those trends. So there are certainly can't discredit the caller. It's a great question, something to think about, these larger operations coming and potentially considering what the implications of different owners coming in. But from my experience with the folks that I have worked with, I would say that I'm scale indifferent. I feel like to see the working land and a perennial forest cover has a lot of positive attributes for water quality and land use and soil holding. So the idea of generating a commercial return from permanent forest to me seems like it hits a lot of the points of light that a lot of people are striving for in agriculture. I really don't want to touch the situation of absentee landowners and other money because that's a fact of many small businesses in Vermont across the board. And I intimately work with folks with their finances, and we see where money comes in gifts or from trusts from other people or other places. So I'm not going to really – I don't want to take a stab at that one.
It sounds like there is some politics in this industry, and that's a tough spot for you, Mark.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's politics in everything, and you know, I think that's where I certainly defer to my role. It can be difficult because I think sometimes people want an extension educator to maybe validate a position or to take sides. And you know, my goal is to be able to go out and work with any manager, whether it's someone up there in northern Vermont that's got a large operation or someone who's got 3,000 taps doing direct marketing, to be able to at least help them make management decisions or give them the tools to make their own decisions for them. And I've got to stay pretty neutral on that in order to deliver what I expect or what I think they expect of me to be there.
Yes, and I think similarly to Mark, as a researcher, I must remain as neutral as I can. What I can tell is when we did the studies, we asked producers, what do you feel are the biggest threats to the industry as well as the biggest opportunities for the industry in the next 5 years? And something that came back over and over again was that theme of overproduction and large-scale operations. But I think if we refer back to what we just talked about different markets, kind of operating in different in different markets, I think that maybe answers some of the question.
Florence, what are you seeing in terms of those markets and in terms of the wholesale market in particular, where Vermont sellers are starting to be able to send their syrup outside even of this country?
So we didn't ask specifically that question, but it came up a lot as an opportunity, as people are talking about the opportunity to sell maple syrup abroad. What came up a lot, too, was people's interest in eating more natural products, consumers eating more natural products, and that maple is that product. If you talk to nutritionists, though, they would tell you that, you know, sugar is sugar, and so, you know, whatever that means.
In other words, you know, health is relative. A healthy food is syrup. Right.
But yeah, it seems like, you know, there were the respondents were talking about European and Asian markets as markets to get into.
Yeah. Mark, what about for you? What are you seeing in terms of those Asian and European markets opening up?
Boy, yeah, that's definitely a step out of my perspective working with managers. I think that, again, at the larger scale, from what we've heard from the annual meetings just this past January with some of the larger packers, they're actively working those markets. I can't say specific to which ones and which countries or which continents, but in general, the demand for maple, they've realized potentially 10% growth in demand annually, and they're projecting that to continue. There might be a little bit of fluttering as the prices shift around globally from year to year, but the outlook for demand is strong, which, you know, in my field then leads to this potential for, you know, increasing production. That outlook is positive.
When we did a show recently on the sort of foundering Canadian dollar, one of the things that we found was that it's affecting syrup producers in Vermont because of what we heard about earlier in the program from Carolyn Sear, this idea that the Global Strategic Reserve and the maple producers in Quebec are really setting the global wholesale price. And because the Canadian dollar is lower compared to the American dollar, it's actually not benefiting American producers. Are you finding that, Mark?
Correct. Yeah, that is the trend that we've all been aware of in the past, well, many years for some, but more acutely, I think, the past year and a half for many. I checked this morning, and the exchange rate, you know, a dollar Canadian is roughly 77 cents U.S., or if you look at the other way, a dollar U.S. is $1.30 Canadian. So, you know, the same syrup coming out of Canada is being marketed to a store here, and the buyers are experiencing whether you consider it a benefit or a discount on the dollar value. So it puts a competitive, it adjusts the price for the similar product that's coming from American producers. So we've been seeing price declines at the farm gate now that's getting passed through from the packers and the bulk markets because of this, just strictly the currency exchange adjustment with where Canada is setting the price.
Even for small-scale producers, like Florence was talking about, who can sell direct to consumers and can set their own price, because we're not beholden to that Canadian price, at least not on the retail market. If you have a sugar house and you have an open house on the weekend, you can sell it for whatever you want, but you're still seeing that price. You know, if somebody can go to the grocery store and get it cheaper, you're seeing that sort of setting prices, Mark, even for smaller-scale people?
Well, I think it's a great question, and we brought this up again in conferences in January where we had a discussion about that and the prices, and retail marketers were saying, well, I've got some flexibility, you know, I can hold my price higher, and we had a discussion about, well, you know, it will depend on your buyers and the loyalty and how those relationships go, because at some point your buyers might prefer to pay a premium for your product for a lot of reasons. There are other buyers that strictly are price sensitive, and if offered the product at a discount and they feel it's of a quality product, they, you know, at some point may start to choose to buy that other product. So there's definitely going to be that competitive pressure when prices are coming in lower from other places. The irony with retail, and we had a very frank discussion with producers about this, where when the price goes up globally, or the market price goes up, the producers often feel like, well, they're not getting that piece of it. The price is going up, but there's a delay until they get that compensation for the price. Their price might stagnate or move a little slower. And so I asked them all quite honestly. I said, well, now it's going the other way, you know, and the global price is going down. And I asked them if they're giving their customers discounts now to stay in line with the prices. And we had a good chuckle about that.
It's sort of like gas prices in a way.
There's so much to retail pricing that can't be, I think, read through through economic statistics. The statistics will be great long term; 2 or 3 or 4 years will shake out. But in a short term blip like this, a lot of it will be based on human decisions and relations, you know, for better or worse.
We are talking today about the economics of the maple industry here in Vermont. And listeners, if you'd like to share your experiences, you can talk about how much you think maple brings into the economy. It goes beyond just direct sales. It goes to jobs. It goes to tourism. Or if you have a question for Mark Canella or Florence Bicot, please give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the challenges the maple industry will be facing, whether it's climate change or forest pests. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Mark Canella is a UVM Extension farm business specialist. Florence Bicot is a research specialist for UVM's Center for Rural Studies and the author of the center's study of Vermont's maple industry. And that's what we're talking about today, the maple industry and the economics of that industry here in Vermont. If you have a question or you want to share what you think of the dollars and cents of this business, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page, where you'll also see the debate producer Rick Sangari and I are having over the correct pronunciation of the word syrup. He incorrectly says syrup, which we all know is absolutely wrong. So go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page. You can weigh in on that argument, and you can share your thoughts about the business, which is what we're actually discussing today. Florence Bicot, I keep mentioning that you were the author, the lead author of this study of Vermont's maple industry that was done for the Center for Rural Studies. Can you talk a little bit about some of your findings?
Sure. So before I forget, I would like to say that I wasn't the only one who worked on that study, and I would like to acknowledge our director of the center, Dr. Joanne Konandinsky, as well as Associate Professor Dr. Connor in the Department of Community Development and Applied Economics. And I also had a few students who helped me do some of the work. But what the study looked at was the economic contribution of the maple industry, that is, the economic activity that is happening in Vermont because of the maple industry. And so it was actually the first time that this kind of study was done in Vermont. So I think there was a lot of excitement. We know that maple is a very important industry for the state, and I think there was a lot of excitement about knowing what about how much. And so what we found is that when we look at the strictly the production side of the maple industry, but when we account for not only the sugar makers, but also the packers, the equipment manufacturers, we find that they contributed between about $212 and $221 million. But when we look at the economic activity that is generated because of the maple industry, that number goes up to between $317 and $330 million in sales. The one thing, though, is that we were not able to get data from everybody in the industry. So it is a conservative estimate.
Yeah, you mentioned at the beginning of the show that you were counting something like 1,800 producers, but the actual sugar makers say there's probably more like 3,000.
Right. So what we ended up doing, why I'm giving a range, is we looked at the contribution using the number from the Census of Agriculture, because that's what's counted, and then we used as upper bound the first estimate of 1,800 producers in the state. The piece that for me was very interesting about maple is that it's such a geocentric industry. So what I mean by that is a lot of the equipment that's used by sugar makers, such as evaporators or reverse osmosis units, is that they're made here in Vermont and to some extent, you know, Quebec. and so by that fact, you have all that additional economic activity that does not happen when you, let's say, you buy a John Deere tractor or you buy a Kubota tractor that it's made somewhere else. So with the maple industry, you have more of that money that stays here in Vermont because the producers are buying their equipment here in Vermont. Another piece, too, is that almost all, from my understanding, almost all of the processing and the distribution is also done here in Vermont. So you have that economic activity. The last piece that I think there are many people who want to know, but that is really really tricky to count, is the tourism impact that's created by the maple industry. So by that, I mean the open house weekend that's coming up early April. There are maple festivals all over the state, and we do know that there are people that come from out of state, drive to Vermont to partake in the festivities related to maple. And so that, again, that is extremely tricky to count, but we know that when we do measure it at some point, this contribution is likely going to be significant.
We got a note from Rachel in Jamaica who says, I'm glad maple syrup brings money and jobs to our sweet state, but I'm happier tapping than buying. For the first time, my six-year-old son and I tapped our one and only maple tree on our land, a fairly young one that we've been whispering sweet nothings to for years. This year, we had a good bucket ready, hung it, and a couple of gallons later had enough syrup for pancakes and French toast. Not much, but it was our syrup cooked on our stove. I heartily encourage all Vermonters to tap for themselves if they can. Far easier than expected, if still a fair amount of time and work. So Rachel and I have the same economic model going for our syrup production. But Mark, when you look and work with syrup producers, and you have these stats now, they came out several months ago from the Center for Rural Studies, does that help inform maple producers in the state about the shape of the industry, you know, where they might want to go, what the potential future is? Does having actual statistics like this help in any way?
Oh, I definitely think so. I think the information, you know, we really pride ourselves with working with producers to help them make information-based decisions. There is no discounting that people make maple because they love it and they find it fun or it's a great community event. But at the business level, We want that the passion and the commitment to maple to also integrate with some of the information that's out there. So if we know that the markets are expanding, but we also know that we might have depressed prices right now with Canadian currency, in my work with producers, we're looking at their cost of production and getting down to a number where these producers will say, if the outlook is bright and the business prospects are bright, I may be looking at adding on a few thousand taps or 5 or 10,000 taps. But when we look at the prices and we look at their cost of production, we've done this with people in the past year or two, we've had that discussion, made the decision that this is not the right time to add on. Although we are committed to an expansion, we think it fits our business and we think it's going to fit in the climate around us with the economics, we might pause on that decision because there's no need to lose money on an expansion for the next year and a half if prices are going to stay below, say, $2.20 a pound. Now we've got a benchmark for them to say, when prices get above $2.35 a pound, that's when we hit the green light on our expansion project. So them being able to take the information from all these different places and synthesize it into their own plan that satisfies their goals, it's just a great thing to be able to do.
I imagine that also applies, too, to if you're thinking about making some changes and getting more efficient equipment or changes to how you boil, you know, that looking at the future and trying to figure out if that's going to be a worthwhile investment is probably pretty essential. I mentioned that there are challenges and things that we're all looking ahead towards, and specifically forest pests, climate change, and other things that could really affect the maple industry in Vermont. Florence, what are you seeing and thinking about our future?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned climate change and pests and changing climate weather patterns, because that is exactly what maple producers talked about in the survey as their biggest worries, is we don't know what's going to happen. I think this year, you know, is a bit of an indication. It was a very different winter, and I think there's been a lot of questions about what is going to happen to the sugaring season.
We got a note from Chris in Addison County who emailed in to say, you might address the incredible cost of maple equipment and how every few years there seems to be the next big thing, which forces producers to gamble on refitting parts of their operation. In the past few years, tap sizes are changing 3 times in the past 15 years, and tubing sizes are changing. To stay current eats up all the profit. Mark, maybe you can wrap Chris's thoughts into the same question about, you know, challenges moving forward and thinking about the future of this industry.
Yeah, certainly. I think he addresses a point that any farmer or producer knows very well, that the industry changes and the technology changes. And as a manager, you're faced with a decision to try to continue to do what you're doing or make that next step or that next commitment, the next investment into a new piece of equipment. And I think the outlook for maple, for folks that have worked on their business model, there is a great potential to pay off those investments. Traditionally, investments that we might say might take 10 years to pay off. I'm working with producers, and we're working, you know, I've got a couple producers. They've got 4.5-year payoffs, and it's great. I always get excited when someone starts talking in decimal points for years. They don't say it's a 5-year payoff. They've got it down to 4.5. So those investments that the caller mentioned, they are sizable, and they get more expensive. The potential for payoff is there if you can match the yield and the efficiency to get your production up. And so I do think there's opportunity to consider each of those investments. And the ones that can pay off sooner are going to be a, it might be a better fit for someone like that. You know, for a 4-year payback is something that's nearer term. A larger payback or a longer time period on the payback, that puts some risk out there for the producer for sure.
Do you see climate change affecting the business here in the future?
You know, I've been working with a small set of producers, and I think they're conscious of climate change, and the way that they're conscious of it is less about their ability to produce sap. Some of the concerns are on the regeneration of the next stand of maples for 60, 80, 100 years out. The other big concern is on storm events. So we do have a lot of conversations about the integrity of their tree stands or the potential to insure against loss. The technology has gotten them very comfortable and confident that they can get the sap at different times of the year now. But there are these other blips in the system that uncertain weather has impact on them. But maple producers, I think, are also very comfortable with dealing with the weather for decades. So
1 minute.
They're working with that, and I think there is optimism, but they're managing risk for sure.
Florence, before we let you guys go, we've had a very serious conversation here about economics and business models and international markets. And I have to ask you, though, what your favorite thing to put maple syrup is, because, you know, we can't talk about maple without talking about eating it.
I always sit in my coffee with cream, whipped cream.
Whipped cream and maple.
Well, you might as well be decadent, right?
Mark, what about for you?
Well, I guess I'd be dating myself if I started to talk about Vermont Fancy because the grades have changed.
Yeah,
but,
I'm with you, though.
I'd have to say that as a former sugar maker, the best thing for me would be to be at a sugar house probably well after sunset and have a sample vial from the grading kit of warm, fresh, light syrup and to sip it right from there.
Okay. All right. You both win. I like to take a little bit of a jar of maple sugar, pure maple sugar, and just eat it raw from the jar every now and then.
That sounds good, too.
Sounds good.
Mark Canella is UVM Extension Farm Business Specialist. Florence Bicot is a research specialist for UVM Center for Rural Studies. She's the lead author of the center's study of Vermont's maple industry, and we have a link up at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up, the art of recycling. Keep an eye out for the colorfully painted recycling containers traveling around Chittenden County these days. They have a dual message, both public beauty and recycling awareness. We'll catch a glimpse next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If you frequent any of the transfer stations in Chittenden County, you may have noticed some changes to the big metal containers you throw your recyclables into. The Chittenden Solid Waste District has initiated a new public art project in collaboration with and with funding from Dealer.com. 8 of the district's big receptacles have been turned over to local artists to beautify, and they're pretty striking. The other day, in full pelting sleet, I met up with CSWD's marketing specialist, Johnny Finity, and with local artist Mary Lacey to see a few of these containers in situ and to talk about the project. We have here 3 recycling containers, I suppose we're supposed to call them. No longer dumpsters. Is that not? I'm getting shake of the head. Johnny, we don't call them dumpsters.
Containers.
Okay. So they're recycling containers and they're 22 feet long, right? And these ones are not the bland green container that may be rusted over. These are gorgeous. Mary, what's going on?
Johnny and I actually met in the fall of last year when I was working on a previous project, the silos at dealer.com. And he talked about these dumpsters being such a viable and unexpected canvas. And that's really where the ideas started. He also talked about the recycle paint program that CSWD runs in their toxic waste depot, where people bring all of their leftover paint and then they recycle it into big new colors. And so at least 25% of all of the paint used to make these containers are also from that recycled paint itself.
And you put together a team of 8 artists, including you, to do these containers?
Yeah, there's a total of 11 artists, 8 containers, because Ant Hill is 3 people and the last container is 2 people, but 8 individuals are teams.
It's beautiful public art because so many people do come and drop off their recycling at the transfer stations around Chittenden County, but you have sort of a goal beyond just having beauty in these scenes. You actually are trying to highlight something.
Yeah, so this is the art of recycling. It's really a celebration of recycling. And so when I first met Mary and saw this public engagement, the community just like loving the work that she was doing, I thought, you know, we have these really functional mobile canvases that people are interacting with on a daily basis to do something really good for the environment, for the community. And it was a great opportunity for her to bring together a team of artists in the community and strengthen that piece, and to use the artistic vision, a lot of color, recycled paint, to give a message that what you're doing has some intrinsic motivation, but it also has, you know, a big part to play in building a more beautiful community.
How do you think it does that? I mean, you can also just imagine people, it's maybe a Saturday afternoon or whatever day you're doing your recycling and your trash drop off, and it's like, I just need to get this done. Great, that's a beautiful container, but I'm still just going to throw my recycling in it, and I don't care what it looks like.
Yeah, I'm not expecting the art to actually, you know, drive people to say like, oh, I need to recycle more because there's art in the container. But it does create a more subtle emotional connection with recycling. When you drop your recyclables off in a beautiful container, you just have a better feeling about it. We get comments all the time. The drop-off center operators have been saying the public response to this has been amazing. The operator here at the Burlington Drop-Off Center actually said it was a home run for the district, the way he described people's feedback. So they really love coming to the drop-off center and seeing this colorful part of their regular routine. And besides just actually having this interaction here, these containers move all over Chittenden County. Once they fill up here at the Burlington Drop-Off Center, they get taken to the materials recovery facility, the recycling center in Williston. They unload the recyclables, and then they're taken to a different drop-off center. And so it was also a way, Mary put it really well, that it's a way of making the invisible visible. You know, when you see these containers going down the road, you know, you can see the impact that the recycling has in a very visual way. Whereas before, actually, I didn't even notice these green containers going down the road because they're green. They're easy to miss. But you can't miss these.
Mary, before we started rolling, you were saying you actually saw one an hour ago, and the excitement in your voice in saying you saw one on the road going somewhere was pretty cool, even though you've seen all of these and you've been such a big part of the project. So that resonates with you too?
Yeah. For me personally, and I think for many people, one of the challenges overcoming waste and reducing it and doing it responsibly is it disappears from your sight after you dispose of recycling or trash or whatever. And remembering that just because it's not in your sight, it does not go away. And so that's my favorite part of them being seen in transit, is that it's even one step further into the unexpected realm of like remembering. I'm more passionate about art being put into an unexpected location versus something that you seek out in within a closed space.
I keep staring at this one in front of us, which is the one that you did. Can we go right up to it and you can tell us a little bit about what you were thinking when you were painting it, what your strategy was, and what it evokes for you?
Well, the content of it, it's an abstract mural of Chittenden County. So we're looking at, right now, downtown Burlington, the waterfront. We are right here.
That's where we are on the map.
It's the area that this CSWD, that the recycle waste is taken care of. And I love the idea of people coming up and being like, where's my house? Or like, where's this? Or where's that? It kind of evokes some interaction, some play there.
Were there any challenges, like physically challenging aspects to working on this kind of container? I mean, you're pretty familiar now with working on various different kinds of materials as the sort of canvas for your work. But what about this one, these containers?
The ridges were very difficult. Like, they're difficult to paint, but I think standing back and in transit, they don't affect the design as much as the artist probably thinks in the moment.
This was the first container that we painted in the whole project, and so it was, you know, we still didn't know what was going to happen. It was like there's this big open end to the project, and it was really exciting to see it all come together. You know, we had just moved into this warehouse space in Essex, this giant warehouse that was donated by Bob Miller from Miller Realty. And so we were, you know, this was this tiny little container inside of this enormous, like, airplane hangar of a warehouse. And Mary's just sitting in there, you know, making these small shapes on this giant container. And so some of the sense that I feel when I look at this is, you know, the sense of accomplishment of, really making this project come to fruition. Yeah.
Well, you're the only artist here, but will you show us the other two? Both of you can describe what we're seeing, because there are three here. We got lucky. You guys didn't expect three to be here, just Mary. So let's look at these other ones. This one is, I take it, the Anthill Collective one. And you can probably guess, because it has ants on it.
Well, my favorite part about this one, when we did mine, it was like the first one, and we were like, oh my God, it's so bright. And it was like, but they totally outdid me on the brightness thing, and it's awesome. that the color in the sky.
And this one has sort of a more graffiti style.
Mm-hmm.
And Johnny, this actually has a recycling theme too, even though it may not be initially obvious to people. The ants, what's up with the ants?
Yeah, so Anthill had a great concept for this from the very beginning, of using the recycled paint as a background of this like explosion of color. And the ants, to them, I mean, they got the concept of the whole project right off right from the start, because the reason they're called Anthill Collective, the reason that ants are a big part of their image, is that they're a community that uses all of their resources and they don't waste anything. And so it was a perfect tie-in to this whole project, because the art of recycling isn't just about recycling. It's a bigger landscape of ideas that includes everything that we do to reduce our impact on the environment and reduce waste that we send to the landfill.
Now, I usually try to avoid any kind of judgment because, you know, I'm a totally impartial journalist, but this is a really crummy day, so I'm not going to keep us out here too much longer, but let's look at the third one before you guys totally freeze. Yeah, it's freezing rain today.
Crummy day, though, they're pretty colorful and happy.
Well, that's the cool thing. I mean, these, how could you not be cheered up looking at a beautiful blue sky with birds flying even when you're being pelted with sleet? Tell me about this one.
This is by Sloan Collins, and he uses stencil work. These are all made with stencils. They are sparrows, specifically. Another animal that is based in community and working together.
What's amazing is how different just these three are. I mean, I know there are five others, and some are still being created, but they're all drastically different.
And that was very intentional, was to have a really strong variety. I like this one because it totally changes the color. There's no green in here. It is not a green dumpster. It is a totally different spectrum coming at you. And then the detail in the stencils on this one is mind-blowing.
Yeah, they're really beautiful. And I love that some of the birds are very detailed and crisp. And then some of them, you know, are either sort of evoking birds that are farther away, but also look sometimes like, you know, if you have an owl that runs up against your screen glass window, it leaves a powdery substance that's the exact outline of the owl. And some of these birds look, I mean, not like they're they've been smashed up against the container, but they're sort of a powdery outline.
The detail in it gets you to go up real close to them. Getting anyone to go up real close to a dumpster.
Not a dumpster.
Oh my God. Don't tell. A container.
Mary, I assume you're sort of accustomed to your work changing over time, because a lot of it is out in the conditions. And work that you've done, for example, at the Moran plant was sort of designed not to last. When you look at these containers, Johnny, and you look at the future of them, what's their sort of lasting impact, even if these are working containers and the way the artwork looks is going to change over time?
Well, these containers, without being painted, last, I think, about 7 to 8 years before we sell them. And we hoped at the start of this project that these murals would last at least a couple of years. I'll be very interested to see how they age, because it's almost like, you know, Mary and these other artists have created a beautiful piece of art, but now the public gets to shape the direction that that art takes. Because as people, you know, open the doors and it gets dropped off at the recycling center, they see a lot of wear and tear. And that age will kind of be a representation of the function of the art. And so I'm really curious to see how they wear over time.
Well, thank you both for coming out on such a rainy, cold, beautiful day in Vermont, spring, and talking about this project. I appreciate
Every day
it.
Is a beautiful day at the drop-off center with these containers.
Now, before I left the drop-off center in Burlington, Johnny Finity actually opened up one of the containers, and we got a chance to experience the empty container from the inside and think about what it could eventually become. This is kind of like a tiny house. I mean, you could put a couch in here and a space.
I've actually thought about that. Once these reach their lifespan, when CSMB is selling them, it would be really cool to turn one of these into a little house. They've already got the windows built into them.
Yeah. And we have some photos of these recycling containers on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Vermont's legislative session has passed the halfway point, so tomorrow we'll get an update from Progressive Party members on how they think the year is going. Representatives Diana Gonzalez of Winooski and Chris Pearson of Burlington share their insight into how progressive priorities are faring so far and their prospects going forward. You can send your questions for them to vermontedition@vpr.net and tune in tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.